Well, I will just briefly introduce our panel moderator, Dave Walden, who, as you know, handles the interview corner and all kinds of interviews, so I asked him to handle this one, too. Dave.
Thank you, Carl. I was really pleased to be invited by Carl to chair this panel for three reasons. First, despite the fact I've lived in Boston for 46 years, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area and graduated in mathematics from San Francisco State. So it's a real pleasure to be back at a meeting. This is probably the first time I've thought about math in San Francisco in 46 years. Second, I've always admired Donald Knuth. I bought his Art of Computer Programming in the late 90s and used it in my daily work. When volumes 2 and 3 came out, I immediately bought them, and we use those in our daily work. More recently, when I decided it was time to stop using Word and go to some kind of a text processing system that didn't have a hidden proprietary undocumented markup, I chose tech because I admired Don Knuth, and I thought I'd like to try something that he used. And, of course, that third reason is that that brought me in contact with this community and through interviews and so on with everybody in this panel. So, third, it's a real pleasure to get to meet everybody here today in person. With that, I'd like to introduce the panel members. I'll do it. I'll first mention Don. It's a cliche to say that he needs no introduction. You have to go around that end. It's a cliche to say he needs no introduction, but with this group and this man, he needs no introduction. I'm sure that all of us are aware of several things in his massive set of accomplishments in a variety of areas. And in fact, his publisher conveniently gave us this list of 9 different books of his collected work in different areas. And that doesn't include The Art of Computer Programming, which has a different publisher. So I'll go through the rest of the panelists in order, and I will introduce you to them, saying a word or two about their tech accomplishments. Naturally, they've had full careers in other areas and have done many other things, and I commend the interview series to you. And the couple of you who haven't yet participated, it's time. So, first, David Fuchs. Don Knuth called David my right-hand man for Tech 82. He also did the initial development of the DVI format. John Hobby developed Metafont's Polygons Pens, which is an important part of his PhD thesis. That went into, of course, Metafont, and then he later, as we know to from today, developed Metapost. Frank Liang worked with Don Knuth on the hyphenation algorithm for Tech 78, and then his PhD thesis presented a better hyphenation algorithm, which is used in the tech we all use today, and by text processing systems all over. Oren Potashnik developed BibTeX, and is a co-author of the Concrete Mathematics book, which uses, of course, a font developed by the Stanford people, Don and the Stanford people. Michael Ploss was the co-implementer with Frank of the original prototype for Tech, and then his PhD thesis presented methods for line breaking and pagination with floats, which are used in Tech. Tom Rokicki developed Tech's original Pascal to C converter and developed DVI-PS. Luis Traub-Pardo, Don called him his right-hand man for the development of Tech 78. He was also involved with the interfacing to the early laser printers and other printers that I don't quite understand. In his interview, he talks about the smell of kerosene, and I want to follow up on that. Howard Trickey did one of the first ports of Tech to Unix. He also did the first 4 BibTeX styles and related utility software. And finally, Joe Weening was involved in various ways in the transitions from Tech 78 to Tech 82, and he maintained the Librea.edu FTP website for Don for a number of years. I think it's still available, is it, or not? No, okay. Okay, so the format for this is, well, and Don in fact, asked me to make an announcement, which is, he says, I'm going to have a half hour to myself later. This is the only time the rest of the panelists get to talk. So please focus as many of the questions as you can on the rest of the panel, said Don. I say that to you. What I'd like to do is go through the panel one by one, and I won't do a strict rotation, but I'll ask for a question. Would you please direct it to one of the panel members? And let's get a question for each panel member before we go to a more open format. And panelists, I encourage you, if you have something to add to what the answer was of one of your fellow panelists, please chip in. I think that hearing different sides of these historical stories is often interesting, both because it elaborates on the stories, or sometimes it shows some conflicts in the stories. So, may I have the first question from the audience? Oh, one more thing. Unless we have a mic in the audience, please say the question loud enough for me to hehear, and then I'll repeat it for Kaveh's videotape. Somebody. This is going to be a... Yes, please. The question for Frank is, how did you discover your hyphenation algorithm? Frank?
Okay. Well, I was assigned this problem as a thesis in 1978, I believe. And there was an initial, as I have mentioned in my thesis, there was an initial suggestion to use this kind of statistical algorithm, which looked at two letters, four letters surrounding a potential breakpoint, and then you were supposed to make tables using the two letters before to the middle two letters and the last two letters, and then combine these tables somehow to do hyphenation. So I started experimenting with some word lists, and I quickly found that that wasn't sufficient. You needed more context because as... And one example I mentioned in my thesis is that sometimes you get a letter, seven letters away from the hyphen point can alter the break point. Anyway, so I'm playing with the word list a lot. I just sort of came upon the idea of that just patterns of letters was a very simple way to, because I had started with just these two-letter diagrams, you know, it was natural to just to extend that to longer letter sequences. And then through a long process of evolution, I came up with patterns and then with the rules and exceptions and thing. And Don actually came up with this idea of assigning the numbers and having the level, one of my thesis review meetings. I mean, I sort of had the idea of rules and exceptions. He said, oh, it's like, you know, you could assign numbers to them, and then so that's part of the answer. Is there anything else? Well, one of the hardest parts of the whole thing was acquiring a suitable word list. It was not, I guess, I didn't have access to every database, and there weren't that many at the time. I got a copy of the Merriam-Webster dictionary that had hyphenation points, but then upon looking through it, there were many errors, and there were lots of both typos and things that just weren't quite right, so I had to hand edit the dictionary, and that took about 3 months, so yeah. So that was where most of the work was, actually.
Any of the other panelists have a comment on this?
The tries, okay, well, that's a separate, that was sort of came up separately when I was looking at, after coming up with the pattern idea and doing, as I was playing around with the word lists all the time, I then I needed some kind of relatively fast algorithm to quickly collect information about the patterns in the word list with hyphenation points and then to test out various theories. So because these were just simple strings, it was natural to look at variations of standard data structures like tries for that, and reading related papers like Don's on pattern matching, you know. And so then I came up with the idea of, well, let's see, I guess the I was using the problem with the tries. The tries are very fast because it's just based on indexing, but they tend to be very sparse, so then you have to use various tricks to speed that up. And the idea actually for doing this weird packing, if that's what you're referring to, was I read another paper by a Stanford professor at the time, Andrew Yao, which was talking about storing a sparse table. And he had this, it was a somewhat different application, but he had this idea of where you have, when you have these sparse things, you can sort of interleave them all in one array and thereby save space while maintaining speed. So that's where I got that idea.
Question for another panelist? Back here, William?
My question is for Tom Rokicki. Ages ago, when the WorldWideWeb.app was written on NextStep, there was also available on that same platform, TechView.app, and we've seen an awful lot of effort in trying to get mathematics and nice fonts and nice settings onto the web. Why didn't we just start out with an extended version of HyperTechView.app on the World Wide Web to cut to the chase?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
No. No, I don't understand the question. Maybe William can say it again, and I'll try to repeat it.
All right. We started out with techview.app on NextStep. And on that same platform, worldwideweb.app was developed by Sir Tim Berners-Lee. Why wasn't techview.app used as the basis for the worldwideweb.app so that mathematics and so forth would have always just worked instead of us constantly working to try to make them work on the web?
So basically you're asking why tech was not chosen as the basis for mathematics on the web. Based on the next stuff. Boy, I'm not really the right person to ask. You know, I really don't have a good answer to that. The HTML stuff was really crude in the beginning, and it's still pretty crude, but it's getting there. So I don't think anybody really spent a lot of focus at that time. I mean, back then it was, let's just get the links working, let's get the text working, let's throw around images and stuff like that and call it a day, and which was pretty amazing in itself. As far as what went after, I really can't say. I mean, I wasn't really involved or anything like that. I'm not sure that it really fits, though, because like the web, HTML, it's all XML-based, and tech is rather different. And I think there was a very strong reason to keep it as a markup language like HTML or XML that could be easily automated and restructured and all this type of stuff. So I think there's actually good reasons that tech was not actually used at that point. So, but I was never really part of that, so I can't say for sure.
Another question? Nelson?
Question for David Fuchs. It's important to remember in this audience, because there are a lot of younger people here who have grown up with laptop computers, that tech was designed in a machine that cost roughly $500,000 at its entry-level price. And there were two people, one of whom is sitting here, who really changed that and made life different for an awful lot of people. And Dave Fuchs is one of those. The other one is Lance Carnes, who unfortunately isn't here today. And I'd just like Dave to comment on his work with Microtech, which brought to you the first live preview while tech was running of what was happening and how difficult and how much hair he lost in trying to get tech to work on the little machines of the day.
Well, that was fun. It was a lot of kind of hackery and trickery down at kind of the bit level and the intricacies of the 8086. At the time, there were no good Pascal compilers, if there ever were. On any machine? No, that's not true. There was good deck ones. So that work involved writing a kind of limited Pascal to C translator that had special hacks, didn't bother with the parts of the language the tech didn't use, had special hacks in it so that I could insert, using the change file scheme from web, I could insert magical, keywords that I made up that said, oh, here's one of the big arrays, and then I could write some assembly code that there was even a version, there were different instantiations of it. One early version, I just pretended to the C compiler that the arrays weren't really big. It always produced one of three different sets of machine code instructions to address those arrays. I had a post-processor that would look through the object code that the compiler created, look for those three or four different possible patterns, insert some special other code that called some of my code to really look up the real array thing. That one lived for a version or two. Then there was, other cute tricks where it kind of used a VME sort of system where I chopped up the arrays into pieces and those got swapped in and out off of the disk. I even stuffed some of them as an experiment into it turns out the video cards that you had that drove your displays, they had some extra RAM in them, so you could swap stuff out to there. And it was kind of fun, because if you put the video card into a different mode, you could actually see that stuff on your screen going by. So the early PCs had a maximum of 640K, and a lot of people for a while had 512K, so that was marginally not quite enough to do everything. So, you had to replace all the runtime libraries that came with the compiler. I was down to, I wasn't even using, what's it called, that usually is linked in with the C program, even the startup code. So you got, there was no standard files, there was no anything. So that was all to cram it down into 512 or 640K. Lance did a job too, and because his stuff was rather commercial, and that was his livelihood. He was always somewhat circumspect about it, it wasn't complete black magic or not secret to me. Tom also had some work in this direction. Am I remembering correct?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. This accomplishment of David Fuchs was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
Please, you just take the mic.
All my platforms had plenty of memory. I never had these issues. I could not believe what David accomplished. It was absolutely amazing. Okay, truly a hero.
Anybody else have experiences with these 90 machines? Phew, huh. No, it's great. Okay, another question, please. Hans.
Aren't you somewhat disappointed after 32 years that not more people made fonts using Metafonts?
Well, I can't say I'm disappointed in the fonts we have now. I'm happy, and I'm happy with the ones that my students have made and that I made. So I'm not, when I wrote it, I just had the idea somebody everybody's entitled to have some mistakes in their life, and so I didn't have to worry about the fact that not everybody would use every program I wrote. And this one happens to be, a very personal thing. So the way I look at it is how wonderful that John extended it to MetaPost, which I use now 100 times more than I use Metaphon. I've already done most of what I ever need to do with Metaphon.
But didn't you overestimate the font designers then, or?
Well, I thought that it would be easier to teach font designers about the notion of parameters and meta design than it was. Computer scientists, we're used to writing something that's going to work under many different conditions as the parameters change. But to most of the rest of the world, to my big surprise, they'd never heard the word parameter. They thought it, they thought it meant perimeter.
John?
Yes, I certainly agree. It's quite natural that the MetaPost application was more popular. Don has a very unusual set of skills. And indeed, there aren't many other people who are good at that kind of thing. I think the real thing is it's just too hard to create a really meta font, unfortunately, as far as the art community is concerned.
Any other comments on that from the panel? Okay, another question for Oren or Michael or Luis or Howard or
I have a
Joe?
Question for Howard, which is I spent a lot of my life looking at tech.ch, and at the top in all those change files, and all of them say pretty much Howard Tricky and Pavel Curtis. And I see Howard Tricky, who I never exactly understood was at Stanford before this conference, but I wonder if you could tell us if you worked directly with Pavel or if it was two independent things or how that came about.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. The fact that that change file has my name in it meant for many years it was really easy to find me on the World Wide Web with like 300,000 references. So thank you all for putting that page up on the web. Don had done his thing on the deck computer, and I worked on VAXes. I didn't like the deck computer, and I wanted this to work on a VAX.
The VAX was from DEC.
You're right. I'm sorry. DEC 20, the DEC 20, okay. As opposed to the VAX. And so I did the work that was necessary, which turned out to be evil, although not nearly as evil as the ways that Dave had to do for his micro thing. I had to change the Pascal compiler to have default clauses. I had to fool around with how Bing reels work. And I had to do the change file that did the system-y stuff that Unix needed. So that's where that change file came. And then I found out, hey, this guy named Pavel Curtis had done exactly the same thing, unknown to me, almost simultaneously. And so we were hooked up together and then cooperated together after that. Thanks.
Anything else on that from the panel?
Which Pascal compiler?
Berkeley's Pascal compiler.
Oh, so you could modify it. It wasn't the deck one.
Can I ask a question to Michael Plass to describe his experiences in 1978 when I went to China and asked him to implement the prototype of tech?
Yes, Don had this trip to China, and he left Frank and me with a few pages of what his ideas were for implementing, what he would like us to implement over the summer. I actually wonder whether I still have those pages somewhere or not. I tend to keep stuff, so it's possible it still exists. That would be interesting. And Frank was tasked with the hyphenation, and I was tasked with building up, starting with the the macro levels, basically starting with storage allocation, I guess, very bottom, and a macro processor, and up through, I think by the time you got back, it was about ready to start implementing some of the line breaking stuff. So we were actually, we were able to, I guess Frank was also working, correct me if I'm wrong, on the output, yeah, the printer driver end of this. So we were able to make some prints by the end of that summer. On the one thing I remember is with the macro language, the way Don had spec'd it out, I did some experiments and he decided it was too powerful. That you could get too tricky with it and do too many things. So he redesigned it to be much more token oriented than it was in the original.
Frank, do you have anything to add to that? If so, pass the mic down.
Okay. Well, what I remember, in addition to the hyphenation, which actually I did while Don was here, was that after looking at those notes, Mike decided he was sort of in charge, and we decided to split it up. I would do the output, and he would do the rest. And I said, didn't sound like much. And he, at the time, he thought, output sounds pretty difficult because maybe he didn't know how to do it right off the bat. And whereas I had already been playing around with the XGP, so I knew how to do it. So for me, actually, it wasn't that much work. And he ended up with much more than he thought. But of course, I also didn't, I think, what he gave me was like a list of boxes or something, graphic boxes. And I said, okay, well, just put them on the printer. And so that wasn't really much work for me. But, but obviously we way underestimated, how much work that was going to be. And so obviously it was two more or several more years of Don's work later. So
I have a follow-up question. In Michael's interview on the TUG website, he says that after Don got back, then he rewrote it all. And so my question for Don is, you didn't like Frank and Michael's work? Or?
No, actually, I liked it. There were basic changes made because I think control sequences were sort of considered as one character at a time. Instead, this tokenization idea was coming along at the end, and so really, the main thing is it gave me the idea for an architecture of a program, but I never expected that I was actually going to use that exact code. I wanted to see it in place, and I wanted to see how big it was and what kind of subroutines were needed and things like that, and so that was a key step in getting going. But I knew my sabbatical year was coming up, and that during that time I always intended to look at what they had, and then and then work over again and say, okay, now back to square one. Now we know what it's going to be like. Now let's design the right data structures that go with this kind of architecture.
Thank you. Question for Oren or Luis or Joe?
Thank you. I have a question for Oren. I always wanted to know what was the inspiration for the style of BibTeX language.
For the style of the BibTeX
language? No, for the BibTeX language itself, or the language for BST files.
BST files. Leslie Lamport needed somebody to do a bibliography program to go along with LaTeX. And his idea was to use sort of as a model scribe. It had a bibliography program. And so he and I sat down, and he had some ideas about things that you'd want in this BST language. And so he and I sat down and kind of discussed it, and then I was the one who implemented that. And so BibTeX itself is really, to a first approximation, an interpreter for this BST language. That's really what BibTeX is. So Leslie Lamport, I think the main ideas for what he had thought about it before, what was going to go into that language, came from Leslie, and then I implemented it. I just wanted to actually follow up in addition to a discussion of literate programming from earlier. I sort of thought about this a little bit over the break, and I went up to my room and got, this is my copy of BibTeX.web. I think Tech.web is probably the largest piece of software in web, and BibTeX.web is maybe the second or third. I'm not sure about Metafont, but it's, you know, like it's a third or maybe two-fifths the size of Tech. And I actually hadn't, all the stuff I've been doing with BibTeX since has been looking more at stuff with the BST language and not with BibTeX itself. They're really very, the only bugs have been really, really minor, except for one. There was one kind of major-ish bug, which was that it didn't handle URLs. Well, back when BibTeX was written, there were no URLs, so I didn't have a chance to test it out on that. And I think I misunderstood something either Don said or Dave said, I don't remember, about how control sequences are handled in it. And so basically, BibTeX doesn't handle the line breaking right for very long URLs. That's the issue. And so finally, I was convinced that I should, and rather than release a version of BibTeX with all these kind of minorish things, that's probably not worth wasting people's time to install a new version for that. Rather than just doing that, I thought I would finally release a new version of BibTeX that had as its only change that change to how BibTeX handled the long URLs. And so I recently did that. A couple months ago, I was working with Carl, and so this is getting back to the literate programming and web. Every time I look at BibTeX itself, I sometimes look at the bits on my computer, and sometimes I look at the hard copy. Every time I look at it, I think kind of what's going on here. But pretty quickly, I then sort of get into it. But I hadn't really had to make a change before until this time, and I realized. Same experience. I looked at it. I knew I'd taken a peek at this, and I thought, well, it's not completely trivial, so I'll you know, do this eventually. And so now is the time to do it. We finally decided now's the time to fix that bug. And I looked at the code, and after just, you know, not very much time, it always takes me a long time to do context switching. I looked at it and said, oh, gee, all of a sudden the structure for what was going on in the program became completely clear. It was like I was in a zone. You hear athletes talk about being in the zone. You know, a basketball player, they all of a sudden the basket looks huge and it's easy for them to make a basket. Or baseball player, the pitch coming in from the pitcher looks like a grapefruit and it's easy for them to hit it. Or, you know, a soccer player knows that they're going to, you know, have a 28-yard direct free kick. And bend it around the wall and get buried into the upper right corner of the net. I mean, you talk about athletes getting in the zone. And I sort of felt like that was the experience I had here. After a little bit of looking at this program, all of a sudden the structure and what was going on became completely clear, and it was really easy for me to make the change. I had just switched computers, and so I didn't actually have a tech implementation on my computer, and I had to use Carl as my debugger. I could, you know, KBDB or something like that. So in the change I made, there was kind of one minor mistake, and so it took two passes. But I was amazed at how initially you look at this code and think what's going on, but very quickly I completely realize the structure. And I think what happens is when you do literate programming, it imposes in your mind a map of what's going on in the program. And it doesn't, you know, it had been 22 years since I'd looked at this code, I think. And after 22 years, it didn't take very much to all of a sudden it came back and it was crystal clear. And I've never felt that experience before. When looking at BST code, that doesn't happen to me. But to get back to BST code, but with a literate program, I think it's because literate programming imposes on you sort of a structure that even when you haven't looked at it for 22 years, it comes back and it's still there.
These pages are very yellow.
Yeah.
Don, you have something to say?
Well, speaking of literate programming reminds me of a question for Joe Weening, because it was Joe who suggested the idea of mini indexes that I used in the Twill program for literate programs, and Joe made some mock-ups of this. Maybe he can remember something more than I can on that.
Well, I remember that, but there, I don't think there's much to say beyond what you just said. It was, I think, pretty simple idea. You know, looking at a page of a literate program, there'd be, if you just grab, you know, go into the middle and look at something, there are a lot of names that you haven't seen before, names of variables, names of other sections of the code, and so on. And so rather than go from each page to an index and then to another page, just the idea was, let's go there directly. And of course, this was before hyperlinking, at least before any of us had heard about hyperlinking. Nowadays, I guess what you'd want to do, you'd be looking at this online and you would just want to click on something. And so that's probably what would take the place of the mini index today.
So certainly we do have the hyperlinks and the clicking now, but still a lot of times there's still a value for this in hard copy when you have a book and you're sitting in your chair or you want to keep the code in, without clicking to the other part. But the thing was, you not only suggested the idea, but you also showed a really nice way to present it and intuitive. But I guess it seems simple to you, but it was a revelation to me.
Okay. Did someone say twill?
Yeah, twill. I don't know if it's on my website. It's not that easy to use, so I don't advertise it much. It requires running in several passes, and when you have a literate program, and you have a variable called X, there might be 30 variables named X, and so you have to disambiguate which one you're talking about, at least when you write code the way I do, which is maybe not the best. And so you have to go through several passes and then give hints and say, no, I didn't mean that X, I meant this X. And you have to tune it to say, oh, but by the way, this is something in such and such a C library. So there's a bit of hand tuning that goes on, and it's not a trivial thing. I just went through, I have a book coming out later this year called Selected Papers on Fun and Games, and in there I have 100 pages of the I took the original program for adventure, the cave game of Don Woods, and I rewrote it as a literate program, and it appears with these mini indexes, but I had to I had to go through carefully and do it. So, but there is the original program used to do volume, you know, the volume B and volume D, tech the program, metafont the program, where it was called Twill, and then now I have C-Twill.
Wasn't there an early version of web? Did Luis work on that? Wasn't there a version of web that was before web?
There was it was called Doc, and it was the Nappies of Oz.
Perhaps one of you could speak a bit about that? Luis, perhaps?
Actually, I was going to ask Luis about the original. Luis was involved with this project so early on that you don't know all anymore what all the key things that happened. So there are, for example, questions of how did we port tech to 100 different computers and get the tapes out and everything like this. People were asking about Maria Code the other day, and somebody said they didn't know if she was a real person or not. And also, you might be able to also speak as to what Inyaki, he's the main person of the original team who isn't here today.
If anybody knows how to reach him, we'd love to hear about it. Okay. Okay.
The question about the idea about literate programming was originally a much more mundane thing. We were distributing tapes, and people wanted to know where was the main. So where does the program start? And I said at the bottom. And my fundamental function at the tech project was to answer the phone. And essentially, answer that question. It's at the bottom. And in some discussions with Don, also there was the issue of documentation. And so the idea of blending that came very naturally as the necessity to not answer questions and have the questions essentially be answered by what you sent. And that was the suggestion. Essentially, Don did the whole thing. And the issue about what Iñaki worked on originally was to start thinking in terms of graphic objects that were going to be put on a workstation. We were in an environment at Stanford that was a timeshare system, and we didn't have much. Well, we did have interesting things going on in there, but the concept of a resource available to you, like what we have today in, on our desktop or on our personal computers, was not there. So he started working from that standpoint, and he actually put together a system that had all kinds of graphic things. He could essentially, he called them graphic objects, and you could do, what you would do today in an environment that displays something, a display environment on an existing system. So that's, I think that answers more or less at this level what Iñaki did.
So when is Maria Code a real person?
Whom?
Maria Code.
Yeah. I believe that was Ron Code's wife. And I remember dealing with Ron as opposed to Maria. So the ARPANET was there, but that was only, you know, academic and government institutions. So it used to be you'd I think send in a tape to Ron and Maria Code, who were entrepreneurs, I suppose. I don't know how they hooked up with us, and they would, you know, spin off a copy for you and send it.
So they weren't members of the Stanford CS department?
No. I don't know how.
Anybody?
What do you know? But I saw him in person. There you go. A ringing endorsement.
The statement from a member of the audience is that Ron worked for him in medical information systems.
Geo
Wiederhold.
Professor Geo Wiederhold.
Yeah.
Maria did all the hard work and Ron managed it.
I believe I gave him the tapes after a while, whenever there was a new release. Following up one thing on what Luis said, when he stopped answering the phone, I was the one who started answering the phone. And
actually, I answered the phone for you.
sorry. I apologize.
But
that's
what the right hand is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right. 1, 2, 3. Okay.
There's a question.
The amazing thing, the experience there to share is that it turns out there's really only 5 questions that anybody ever asked. So after a while, if you called and you happened to get me, you could start asking your question, and I'd be able to answer it before you were done. And not only that, after a while I got so I could say, and by the way, the next question you're going to ask. and so people thought I was brilliant from this, but it turns out it's all a fake. You can do it too.
There's a question out here.
Yeah. Something totally different. The first part of the question is probably for Don, and the second part for everyone. I would like to know why Tech was designed as a macro expansion system. And the second part of the question is for all of you, how do you regard that design decision 30 years later?
So the way Tech was designed was the following. I thought I would have a language for myself and my secretary, and I sat down one night and I wrote out. I chose about 7 pages of The Art of Computer Programming that had different kinds of features on them, and I said, "How, if I were entering this into a computer, what how would I like to do it?" And I wrote that down. It's all there in the book, Digital Typography, the memo that I stayed up late one night writing that out. And then I figured out, and I changed it a little bit, have something that I thought I could implement, and then I gave it to Michael and Frank to implement while I went to China. But the design, it was natural there. It was natural to have macros rather than procedure calls. The way I looked at things, because of the way I wanted to custom, the way I could conceive of writing this program. Second question: is it worthwhile? Well, you have to wait for my next talk. But I don't know what the other people on the panel think.
Anybody else have a comment on that?
Actually, I do. One other thing to keep in mind, people going, oh my gosh, you know, how could you possibly fit it in 640K back in the PC days? Well, it's important to realize that the big DEC 10 that it was developed on was a 36-bit word machine, let's call that 4 bytes more or less, and you only got 2 to the 18th of those, so that's only a megabyte, and the whole thing, even in the big version, fit in a megabyte. And boy, when you look at a lot of the decisions, at least from my perspective, it was driven by that. It's amazing you can do that much in that little memory.
When I got to Metafont, then it was macros gone berserk because I have object-oriented macros in there.
Anybody else? Another question from the audience? Yes, please.
Question to Don Knut. Was it the backslash from the beginning? And why actually the backslash introducing any tech command?
The question is, was it always the backslash that introduced tech commands?
Yeah, you can see exactly what it always was just by reading that chapter. I guess there's 2 chapters in the book, Digital Typography. Answer every question you want to know about where it was that at the beginning.
Yes?
I think my very first draft I did not have reserved words because I was thinking of NROF, they didn't have the idea of backslashes, so then I wouldn't be able to use certain words. But that didn't last very long.
Question over here.
So my question is,
it's working now.
You hear? Oh, there we go. Okay, now I'll whisper. This is partly for Don, but for anybody else, is when did you first become aware of the PostScript language or its predecessor, JAM, and to what extent was there any influence of that design to tech or perhaps backwards?
Michael has an answer, maybe?
After I graduated from Stanford, I started at Xerox PARC in the lab where Chuck Geschke and John Warnock were. And at the time, JAM was in use. By that time, they had already, translated TEC 78 into Mesa, so it could run on Altos and the other machines in use there. So I don't know how much, I really don't know how much they influenced each other, but I think the tech stuff probably predated a lot of the work.
I did learn JAM one summer very early in my graduate career, but it was just part of my education.
Yeah, I didn't look at PostScript very much itself, but I did visit PARC rather often, and I saw, I can remember one of the first times I went there, going by a room where Butler Lampson is sitting at a terminal, and he has a big letter B there that he's measuring. And so when I took my sabbatical year that first year in 1978, I asked Xerox PARC if I could work there to do my font work, and I was going to measure all the letters in my book and with splines and everything, and they said, well, that'd be fine, but then all of your fonts belong to Xerox. So I went back to Stanford AI Lab and decided to do it myself. But so there was a lot of work going on at PARC in this, and Warnock actually had brought this stuff from Utah before, which I learned that later. But then the other main influence is that after I'm meeting in the 80s, I'm meeting the leaders of the font industry and Mike Parker comes from Mergenthaler and says, boy, there's some guys over that have this PostScript language that renders fonts in an incredibly fast way from outlines and things like this. And he was all excited about that. And they had new ways of tuning the fonts to the raster dynamically, hints they call it now. So that's when I first learned myself about that kind of work with PostScript.
I have a question. When in his interview, John Hobby says that he worked with Don on Metafont, but he primarily worked on the algorithms, and Don did the coding himself. And I'm wondering, with Frank and Michael in hyphenation and paragraphing, was it the same situation there, or did any of the rest of you actually touch the tech code?
So let me say that they were watching me over my shoulder. especially David. But if you look at the at the error log, you'll see, for example, like I think there'll be several entries saying HWT in them. That's Howard Tricky, and so on. The error log is also printed in that digital typography book. The idea was really I was the filter in the funnel, and we had this group that would meet once a week. And we would discuss for lunch maybe 2 or 3 hours though, and we would toss around whatever the topic of the week was, but everybody was participating and looking at these decisions during that time, and then I would have to go back. Usually I would have a new chapter of the manual written, and then they would look at it and say, well, why did you do that and all that. And then they would shoot out ideas and say, let's put this feature in, but then I didn't want the project to diverge. So I basically decided, okay, I'm going to make sure this is a little bit unified by being the only person who wrote the code. It's also because I guess I'm a little, afraid of using something that I don't really understand all the way through.
Anybody else want to comment on the collaboration with Don?
Let me just follow up quick with that. For a while when I was answering the phone, I was also kind of the gatekeeper of people thought they found the bug, which frequently they hadn't. But when people reported, I'd go, okay. And I'd, check it out and see that it seemed like it didn't work. And then I'd go into the code and it didn't happen that often, but I'd try and come up and find the exact line that was the problem and come up with a suggested solution, in real code and test it out. And then I'd send it along to Professor Knuth. And not once did the corrected version come back that matched what I had suggested. Never happened. It's all his code.
Yeah. Luis? Would you pass the mic down?
I think I have a comment in the opposite direction, which is the influence of what was happening, what Don's area of work and expertise meant to all of us that were working in there. And I want to contrast that with my experience in industry later on. one of the things that you see in the development of tech and Metaphone is a concurrent solution of a large body of problems that were not solved in a particularly efficient way, or they were solved in different places. And many algorithms were redone or adapted or whatever, but there was always this... this group of people is a group of people that have learned about algorithms and about how to do them efficiently. And to solve complex algorithms, not the trivial, and solve them in an efficient way, not just take the trivial answer and just be happy with it. One of the things I've seen repeatedly in my experience in industry is that many, many engineers just decide, it works, bye. If you try to do tech or Metaphone that way, it will not work because maybe some things will be solved, but the totality will not work. The other thing is the issue about efficiency and optimality of things. My own little experience on this was at the beginning we needed to interface things. And I remember a conversation with the engineers at Canon that had brought to Stanford an OEM printer with no controller. And they said, we did the printer, but the controller is very difficult. So he said, well, we'll do the controller. Can you give us the printer? We had a discussion about it. And what we did in there was essentially to think about how could we use things that we had, like a little microprocessor, add a little bit, a few things, and we got a controller being done there. The industry was not willing to go that way. They would say, oh, it's a complicated thing. We need a lot of memory, a lot of power in it. What we had at that point were people that, given a problem, would just figure out how to solve it with the things that they have there. And I guess that's what made it possible.
Carl?
I guess this is a question for everybody except Don, which is, per his request, given all the comments about literate programming, both by Don and now by Oren, I wonder if any of you have seen literate programming after your tech life in any way. I was afraid of that.
Yeah, has anybody seen literate programming in their life after Stanford, after tech?
Well, used, done, seen, done by somebody else.
I don't claim to be capable of writing very well, but for a number of my projects, I have used literate programming techniques for a delivered product. In my modern life, I don't. You know, for fun I do, but not for anything that I do commercially or anything like that. But a number of the projects I delivered, both during and after grad school, I based on literate programming ideas. I didn't necessarily use C Web. For instance, one project I did, it was a scheme language program. I couldn't exactly use C Web for that. But certainly the concept of a linear exposition of the ideas, small sections, and focusing the effort on allowing readers to understand your program was the goal I was shooting for, as opposed to just letting the compiler accept it and letting it pass all the unit tests and stuff like that.
Luis?
I think if you just take a sample of what you have out there, you would say that probably documentation is never done within 2 or 3 years of the release of a project. So essentially, there is no priority anywhere in the workplace to anything close to this idea of presenting the totality of the concept, the implementation details, and the actual implementation in one place. You would be fired if you try to do it.
There's a question back here. Yeah. Oh, wait a second. Don wanted to say something. Hold that question.
About 20 years ago when Bill Gates visited Stanford, I gave him a copy of the book Literate Programming. I just wonder, Frank, if anybody in Redmond ever saw it.
20 years ago, I think I had already left Microsoft. My office was right next to Bill Gates for about a year, but I hardly ever saw him, except he would walk by in the morning and he would walk out in the evening. So I'm sorry, I didn't. We used at Microsoft, we had all our, when I was there, we had all our own development system, which was kind of inspired by another Stanford graduate, Charles Simonyi. He had something called Hungarian. I don't know how many of you know or are familiar with that. And sure. We used those conventions at Microsoft in the early days. Now, of course, the organization is so huge, I don't really know.
Let's go back to the question here.
This is a question for Donald Knuth, and it relates to, I guess, what we might loosely call the mysticism or spirituality of tech. So, what I loosely would call maybe the mysticism or spirituality of the topic. One of the classes that I teach in the philosophy department is religions of the West. And in the Christianity segment, I actually use Bible texts illuminated. We don't have time to read the whole Bible. And of course, that covers a number of religions. And even if it only covered Christianity, we wouldn't have enough time to cover the entire Bible. But, you know, taking on your own approach, this is one of the texts that I use in that class. And before I ask the question, I want to make one more brief contextual comment about this. In my own work, which involves the study of Arabic manuscripts, a lot of which relate to spiritual literature, one of the things that I've encountered is the need to begin to philosophically deal with the aesthetics, for example, of Arabic script. And then I start coming across certain sayings in my own tradition, which, you know, as a Muslim, for example, beautiful script makes the reality that it represents become more obvious. Or that God is beautiful and he loves beauty, and he loves to see his creation create beauty. So my question for you is, when you reflect on your years of work developing tech, and when you look at your interaction with the written word, what spiritual or aesthetic reflections or wisdoms would you like to share at this juncture, given these years of digression that turned into such a beautiful product? What kind of spiritual or aesthetic reflections or philosophical reflections would you like to share with us?
So in the first place, it sounds like we're on the same page with respect to our feelings about the primacy of having beautiful things. Secondly, the second thought that came to mind quickly was when tech itself became a reality was the moment that that it had a name. And that also goes into the religious concepts, of naming something, and so on. And then when Dwayne Bibby came along, it actually got more of some kind of a soul. I don't know, but anyway, the project was from the beginning was definitely driven by the idea that I wanted to. I wanted to have the things that I myself was writing would be something that people would like to would enjoy looking at, and not just reading, but also somehow with the idea that it was that I liked it enough to also also present it well. I wanted to dot the I's and cross the T's and care about ligatures and things like that instead of just getting the formulas right. So that's not shared by everybody, and all of these questions are very personal, but certainly I think a lot of the muses would agree with this kind of opinion. So.
Bart?
This is for everybody except Don. When Don was about to release or started to do 3.0, several of us got an email of, are there any features that you think should be added to 3.0? I know I sent him a list of it later I thought were dumb. Mine didn't make it, but did any of you say, here are features that you ought to be putting in text that didn't get there? And if so, what were they?
I remember one that made it there, which was the one character font name argument. I remember the day we all yelled about that back and forth, and it was nice to get multi character font names in the text.
That was well before
3.0. No, that was. That was before 1.0. The original Tech 78, there was font A, font B, font C. I mean, you know, there wasn't any room for storing more than 32 fonts, I think, total. So why should we allow multiple fonting?
I was trying to remember what year was Tech 3.0. I
mean,
1990, yeah. So the big thing was like 256 character fonts and features like that. I think most of us were gone from Stanford, right? Tom, maybe you were still around.
But I like his question. What ideas did you...
What ideas did you guys propose at our weekly meetings that I ignored? You know, that'd be great.
I think I wanted to make control sequence names not be case sensitive, and you insisted that they be case sensitive, and just a matter of personal preference.
I agree with Don.
I guess I was a Fortran programmer for too long.
I have a kind of a follow-on question. This is kind of the question was asked was kind of a legacy question. I have a slightly more down-to-earth legacy question. I'll direct it to Tom. But I think it's probably true for all the rest of you in one way or another. Tom, at one point you developed Web2C and you developed DVIPS, and then somehow you got somebody else to take it over or somebody else took it away from you. How do you feel about the separation and the continuing life?
Oh boy. Appreciative, I guess is the word. I mean, truly so. I mean, not actively using the program that much, not actively supporting, you know, a bunch of people. It's a different world, you know, when you get out of it, and it's hard for me to deal with some of the problems people were having because I mean I wasn't really running it or anything like that, and you know there were a number of issues with DVIPS. Part of it was that you know there was a certain effort to make it be GNU. And then at the same time, I really wanted to keep it free of the copyleft. And turned out GNU ended up winning. But I really tried to keep a separation there for a while. And it turned out to be a bad idea. Just make it all be copyleft and all is good. But I don't know. You know, I'm just really grateful that people took up the leadership role and made it all happen and kept it all working well. Because
I wasn't doing that.
I could add a comment to that in that clearly I also gave up a leadership role. In my case, clearly I was eager to give it up simply because I didn't have time enough to adequately maintain the program. But anyway, I think we're all glad to give up the leadership role.
Warren needs a comment now.
Yeah.
Yeah, my comment was I never let that stop me. But
You have a new release of BibTeX coming out? Or?
Yeah, BibTeX 1.0 is going to come out any decade now.
Another question from the audience, please. There's one way back here. Frank, is it Frank back there? Yeah, Frank.
Leslie Lamport has been a big influence on all of these developments. Could you perhaps comment on how you saw his motivation and what sort of interaction he had with the group?
Well, I'll comment a little bit since my real first, other people here are really know more of the tech internals than everybody else does than I do. And so my first contact with a lot of the tech stuff was through Leslie. And as I said before, he needed somebody to do a bibliography processor for LaTeX. And I know his thinking was he kind of liked the path that Brian Reed took with Scribe. It was a very kind of simple interface. You could describe things fairly succinctly. Somebody who's an English major could easily use it and get nice output. And so... I think that was the first contact I had was with him. I don't know how much he was involved with the tech project before that. Then he was with
DeckWest,
SRI, right?
Oh, SRI.
That people like he had written some macros that people liked there, and I think they encouraged him to do something with it. And I think I'm not sure exactly where his other influences were, but certainly once he got going, I mean I think people obviously feel like they're fairly happy with, you know, what developed.
Anybody else?
Yeah, no, he's a very independent spirit, like I am, you know, does a lot of work on his own, so I would only, every once in a while he'd run into something he couldn't do, and so then I would have to put in another feature, kicking and screaming, but it was totally independent work. Of Stanford.
Right here.
Yeah.
In the front row.
We know how the problem of typesetting in the art of computer programming caused tech to be bored. So my question really is, apart from making the art of computer programming more beautiful.
How, in other ways, did tech affect the art of computer programming?
Well, it set it back about 15 years. I think. on the other hand, I'm writing it a little bit faster now, so maybe maybe it'll save 20 years in the future. If we amortize the whole thing. I thought you were going to ask about other things besides the art of computer programming.
No, I mean the stuff that's inside, not necessarily the
time. So the thing is, to my great surprise, right from the get-go, I had, for example, Barbara Beaton came with a few other people during the summer of 1978, and she showed me all the kind of things that she wanted to do with math reviews. And then they also, AMS was having trouble typesetting journals and things like this, so I started looking at applications of other users. This meant that tech had to grow in lots of ways. But it was it was sort of going from one user to 10 users, and then from 10 users to 100 users, from 100 users to 1,000 users. Each time the language had to change in some way. And I think the fact that all these things had to be filtered and come down to me helped to keep the thing from diverging. Although, of course, no complicated system is perfect. It would have been a lot worse if we hadn't done it that way.
Frank?
Question for Michael, I guess. I consider the paragraph algorithm as one of the really central algorithms within what actually has been achieved with tech. And it grew over time. I knew your thesis, and I've seen other papers around it. But my question is, as far as anybody can remember, have there been things you were sort of experimenting with that you would like to have in addition of in that kind of algorithm, like in parameterization or something that you either never got around doing or found too difficult or got shut down for other reasons? I mean, is this the ultimate thing you wanted to have as a group in terms of being able to do this kind of thing, or is there sort of stuff that back then was not possible for some reason but conceptually was on the horizon?
A lot of the features that were built into the line-breaking algorithm itself that's in tech, I think Knuth ended up putting in there based on experience. As far as the actual coding of the algorithm, he did that. The origin of the problem was actually in the first year the first graduate seminar programming class, where there was a problem for doing this, and I guess he was thinking ahead a little bit to his sabbatical year even at that time, for breaking up, I think the problem was musical composition, if I remember right. But it's very similar thing. I guess as far as something that it would be nice if more of it were used in practice is the stuff that is in my thesis about breaking or arranging figures, moving figures from page to page, which, at the time it was certainly way too expensive to actually consider using in a real typesetting program. Maybe today it's not to pull some of those ideas. Oh. Yeah.
Okay, so homework problem, Frank. Go look at Michael's paper. He wrote a short version of our joint paper, which was published in another book about typography at the time. And he generalized what we had and had an idea of a kerf, K-E-R-F. And I don't remember what it was, but except that it was good.
Kerf is something to do with the saw in real life, isn't it?
Okay, but anyway, it was in his paper, and if Michael can't remember it today either, anyway, I think it's worth resurrecting. I wanted to mention something before I forget it. Although I wrote the main code that people saw for Tech and Metafont, there were also drivers and many other programs that had to be written, various TF to PL and all kind of other what we call utility things, and Tom Rokicki did the things associated with PK fonts, for example. David remarked briefly about having to take all of the tech code and convert it to C. Well, he did this. He wrote a long web program that did this, and then I modified it slightly so that it would make profiles of the text system, and so we could instrument the whole program and find out how many times every instruction was done, and then David worked out a very clever thing that would work on our computer, and it would I think Joe Weening worked on this too, there would be demons that would keep track of these statistics, and so over a whole year's time, every time anybody ran tech at Stanford, these statistics were kept and the counts were accumulated and carefully saved. You know, the machines crashing every day, but still putting this all together, and then using David's profiling program, I could make a pretty printed version, which would associate with every line of text exactly how many times people had used that line, and it's really important. For example, how many times did each error message get issued during a year, and you know, to figure out what the bottlenecks this way. So anyway, to make a long story shorter, there's lots of other programs that were written at that time that were necessary for the development. But didn't go out to the world.
Well, we invited questions. Oh, is there another comment down there?
I was going to say I had completely forgotten all about that. It sounds familiar, but I don't remember the details on it. So thanks.
The DEC 20 had the memory was divided into two parts, and there was one part that was always there for the system libraries and things like this, and that's where all these statistics were living. There might be 10 people using tech, but only one copy of tech is running somehow on the machine, and that took a lot of system wizardry. I had no idea how they did it.
You want to know? So this was on actually the DEC 10, which had the weights operating system, which was custom built at Stanford. That 2 to the 18th address space, it was half code, half data, and the code segments were all shared. So if many people on this time sharing system were running tech at the same time, or any program, you know, the editor, the system editor, there'd only be in physical memory one copy of the code, but everybody had their own separate data, so I was editing my file and you're editing your file. Well, the trick was we wanted to count every execution of every basic block of tech, every line of code more or less. So the compiler we used on that machine was this terrible thing from Hamburg that half the comments were in German, which I suppose was okay, but the compiler was not very good, but I managed to modify it so that a lot of modified compilers here, so that it would spit out a little increment, atomic increment instructions every time it entered a basic block. The trick was that the memory locations it would increment were in the what should have been the read-only code segment that was shared among all the users. People who know hardware are raising their eyebrows. So that was fun. And every day or so, it would save itself out the disk. And, you know, there was special code that could retrieve this stuff out of the code segment. And it would actually increment, if the program counter was dot, it would increment dot plus two and then jump over it. So that, there was enough room for all the data for sure. Yeah. So that was another great piece of fun. This was back in the day. I mean, the point is that resources were really tight, and it was hard to fit stuff in, and you had to do all sorts of hackery.
I think we may be getting a little overly sentimental now. Tom, did you have something to add? Or not? No? Well, over the last couple of days, trying to help this panel go more smoothly, we invited questions to be submitted in advance, and I have two, and so I better ask them. Or else I'll be very rude. And I'm going to combine them in a sense. The one question is, in your legacy, where does your work with tech stack up? Now, that's kind of a tech-centric question, but that's the question. And the other question is, because people are curious, what are you doing now? So I think those two questions go well together. You've done a lot of things since then. Where does tech fit into your life adventure? If anybody would like to answer that.
So you want us all to answer?
No. Whatever. Anybody who wants to answer. We don't have to have everybody answer.
Sure. Well, okay, I'll give you an answer first of all. Certainly, MetaPost is one of the most visible things I've done. I'd sort of not like it to be the highlight of my scientific career, but all I can say is, sure, it was a great experience, and I'm happy to have worked on it. And I'm not surprised that it can somehow overshadow a little bit of the other stuff I wish were a little more important.
Tom?
Well, let's see. Coming and working on the tech project for me was absolutely, changing. Because at Texas A&M, I was a bit of a cowboy coder. I wasn't CS. I was EE. I was always pushing electrons, not bits. But I enjoyed, programming a lot, and I learned a lot myself and all that. But coming to Stanford and being with some of these people, it really taught me a lot about how to program right, how to program correctly, and the importance of, literate programming and that sort of thing. So, absolutely pivotal. As far as what I'm doing now, I'm a web programmer nowadays. I've got a little startup down in Santa Clara, and we write huge applications for enterprise applications for Fortune 500 companies. And as far as legacy, I could not ask for anything better than to be associated with this group of people in this project. So I have absolutely no problem with this being, the big thing.
Anybody else have a comment? Not required. Luis?
It essentially sent me in a direction in life that I had never expected to be. I was a student of dance, and I was going to do something academically tainted. and it ended up in industry. And essentially, the one thing I think I have the most is in what I recall my time at Stanford, a part of the project, is the quality of what was being done. At that point, I was never able to achieve an industry because I went into the printing industry. I worked creating laser printers and doing some architecture for that. You can never do it. You can never go back to that level of excellence. And I have to thank all the people here and, of course, Don for that.
Joe?
I was going to say something. I think that I'm very proud to be associated with this because, there's the comparison between things like Scribe and things like tech when the kind of utilitarian thing that was easy to use, and then tech appealed to me because of the beauty part of it. We were talking about the beauty earlier. And I'm very proud to have been part of something that brought a lot of beauty to texts for many, many years that everybody has been producing. I think the world would have been a much uglier place if we hadn't done what we had done, but especially, of course, Don, to do this. I like the fact that many, many people have written a piece or have run a piece of code that I have written because of this project, so that's the legacy part there. Now I work on Google Maps and I wrote business ranking code, which maybe is starting to exceed the number of instructions executed.
Yeah, I guess just thinking about that, what I enjoyed the most, it's always been sort of part of what I like to do, is to see something that I like and make it better by adding features or doing things that I would like to see in that project. And I think all of us at this table have done that, and so we were each able to contribute in our own way to the tech project. And just thinking of it in a larger sense, this is what Don has done for this whole community, is to take what he needed and what he wanted to see for his books and then make a really big software project out of that has had a lasting legacy. So I think we're all proud to be part of it in that sense.
I'd like to make an observation. I think we're almost at time out. I'd like to make an observation. I joined the tech community, 10 years ago, roughly, something like that. And at the time, it seemed to me that there was some depression, I sensed. You know, things weren't changing, things were getting... Now, of course, a lot of development was going on all the time. But today, at this meeting, I have a sense that it's a very active development community. People are excited about things. And I'm just so impressed that something that started 32 years ago was done in a way that enabled that group of people to pass it on to another set of people, that group of people to pass it on to yet another set of people. I'm not sure what generation we're on now. Surely there's been some people who've been involved more or less the whole time. And today it remains a vibrant community trying to achieve the beauty that this group of people set out to achieve. With that, I think we should call an end to this session. The panelists, I'd like to thank you all for both your participation today and for everything you've done for us that led us to be here today.